Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network. A 2022 survey from the National Education Association found that 55% of educators said they were considering leaving the profession. More than half. Why? Is it the pandemic? Is it the politics, the parents, the pay? And what do teachers have to say about it all? We're listening back now to a conversation, and you can tell us what you think at any time by emailing us ideas@wpr.org. Are you a teacher, and what's it like in your classroom today? How does the classroom affect your life outside the classroom? Have you considered leaving the profession? Or if you've already left, have you considered getting back in, unretiring? Join us with an email at any time, ideas@wpr.org. Alexandra Robbins is an author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. Her books include The Overachievers, The Secret Lives of Driven Kids. Her latest is called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I talked with her about it earlier this year. Here's a listen. So let's start with that National Education Association survey from last year. It found that 55% of educators were considering leaving their profession. What's your reaction to that?
That number might actually be low. The morale among teachers is extremely low right now. And it's not just because of the pandemic. The issues in the education system started before the pandemic. It's just the pandemic exacerbated them, and the treatment of teachers has gotten worse.
So it's not just the pandemic then. So what were these issues before the pandemic that teachers were seeing that were driving them to consider leaving the job?
Sure. Well, teachers are incredibly hardworking professionals who work an alarming number of hours unpaid, but instead of our gratitude and a proper salary, they're getting disparaged and demoralized. Right now, the teacher pay gap has hit a record high. U.S. teachers earn 24% less than professionals with similar education and experience. That's demoralizing. Then you have a job where district officials and sometimes principals pile on extra responsibilities onto teachers without giving them the resources, support staff, or planning time to do that within their paid contractual hours. So teachers are working late into the night, almost every night, trying to get their job done.
And yet at the same time, as you write in your new book, the teachers, they often have to take on secondary jobs just to pay the bills.
That's right. So I followed 3 teachers for a year to make it sort of an interesting behind-the-scenes story with characters whom readers would work for. One of those teachers, Penny, she was an 18-year teaching veteran, an award-winning teacher, and she was making $47,000 a year. And she couldn't live on that. She had 2 extra jobs.
And there are 2 others that we'll get to, but we should also mention, Alexandra, that you were a substitute teacher as well. How did that experience suit you?
So it's interesting. I see what teachers mean by they love teaching, but they do not love being a teacher. The act of teaching is beautiful, just connecting with students and colleagues and having this mutual learning and growing experience and impacting their lives and seeing them make connections. There's just joy and exhilaration in that. You know, I grew up playing sports and I've experienced runner's high during sports, but teacher's high is way better. However, I subbed almost the whole year. I subbed more than 150 days out of 180. And for the whole year, including almost a semester spent as a full-time third grade teacher, I made $17,000. So I understand what teachers are going through.
Wow. And you write about this in your book. And here's a quote I've got highlighted. Making joy happen is a driving force unlike any other I have ever experienced. So when we talk about why teachers stay, this has to be at least one of the big underlying reasons, Alexandra.
They stay for the students. Absolutely. They leave because the adults. It's true. They leave because of administrators. They leave because of district officials. They leave because of parents. Whoo, you want to talk about parents? That's a whole other show.
So introduce us to the 3 teachers that you shadowed for a whole school year. And I think you mentioned Penny, who was an 18-year teacher who was making less than $50,000 as a 6th grade math teacher.
Yes, she was a math teacher in the South. I followed Miguel, a Western special ed teacher who was fighting to save both his school and the special ed program that his school board was trying to destroy, and Rebecca, an East Coast elementary school teacher. Now, Rebecca, she hadn't had a date in 5 years because her work was all-consuming, and her boyfriend had even broken up with her because he said she was spending so much time at home working on teaching rather than paying attention to him. So I followed her the year she tried to get back into the dating pool to see if she could teach and have a work-life balance at the same time.
Yeah, and she couldn't.
I'm not going to spoil it for anyone.
But it was...
it's a story that we follow, and you know, the ups and the downs and the maybes.
And I got it. You start the book with the start of a new school year, and I got that feeling of the anxiety, but the excitement of the start of a new school year. And as you detail, it's not just the students that feel that way, it's the teachers as well. They get excited for this school year, and then you go through the school year in your book month by month, and it's just, it sounds like such a challenge to just get back to that making joy that is such a cause or reason for teachers to do what they do.
And you know what one of the hardest months of the year is? Right now, March. Some teachers call it Death March because it's like this long slog with no break or holidays.
Yeah, that sounds about right. How big of an issue do you see perception versus reality being here? The work of teachers and public opinion or even portrayal in the news media compared to what you saw and what you experienced in your work for this new book?
The public has no idea what teachers really go through. That was the point of the book. I want the public to be aware of educators' unacceptable working conditions. This wouldn't be tolerated in any other job. We dump so much stuff on teachers. But yet I also wanted the public to see the joys that teachers feel and just how much teachers go above and beyond for, they call them their kids. They don't call them their students. I interviewed hundreds of teachers across the country, and they all said, "My kids." And that's how they really feel.
Alexandra Robbins, our guest. She is the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Just this week, the New York Times listed it as one of 19 works of nonfiction to read this spring. And here's another quote from the book that stuck with me that you were speaking about, Alexandra. Teachers are the country's silent, constant superheroes, and that's a big problem. They shouldn't be our superheroes, you write. Why?
Because what has happened is that teachers have become, as I said, the dumping ground. It's like all of society's failures, all of the government's failures rest on teachers' shoulders. And I'll give you a sort of a somber example of that. The only thing that changed between the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre and the 2022 Robb Elementary School massacre was that teachers were trained to hide their students and barricade the door. Nothing else really changed substantively in society. So this is an example of teachers having to bear the weight and responsibility for society's failures. We saw in the pandemic that public schools were having to feed children because the government wasn't taking care of them. Again, we had to go to teachers and school staff to feed food insecure students. It's like everything comes down to teachers, and they're not being paid for it.
Going above and beyond on a regular basis. So you also talk about, and I think this is towards the end of your book, Alexander, about the catch-22 that the education system itself finds itself in with, you know, a void for teachers, the need for teachers, an education system that would need to change in order to get more teachers. So what comes first? How does the education system change to accommodate a teacher being able to afford to live and do what they love?
Yeah, the job has to change. First, higher pay for teachers. And I don't mean that glibly. Studies actually show that students' math and English scores are significantly higher in districts that have higher base salaries for teachers. We also need more support staff, more counselors, aides, paraeducators, and a full-time nurse in every school. And most of all, we need a job that can actually be managed during teachers' paid contracted hours at school rather than bleed late into the night unpaid.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with author of 5 best-selling New York Times books, Alexandra Robbins, about her new book, which came out yesterday. It's called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. It follows 3 teachers throughout the school year, and we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest, and what's resonating with you here? What strikes a chord? Whether you are a teacher, a student, a parent, administrator, the custodial staff, it all goes into making it happen every day in the classroom. How are the connections with the teachers and the parents? What do you see from where you sit today about education in America right now? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with the author and reporter Alexandra Robbins. Her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. And we want to hear what you think about your teachers today, past, present, 1-800-642-1234. And if you're an educator in the classroom, share what you see. 1-800-642-1234. Have you considered looking for another job elsewhere? What is it that keeps you with these kids? You can also email us ideas@WPR.org or share your observations on our Facebook Ideas Network Facebook page. And what about the politics of teaching today, Alexandra? Where are the perils in that?
Well, we live in a very strange time. We live in a time where certain politicians are pushing to censor teaching and classroom discussions of race, racism, gender, and LGBTQ issues. They're galvanizing parents by packaging these measures as parents' rights. However, this does not include all parents. Their messages of exclusion and bigotry pander to only a certain small subset of parents. And what this has done in the education landscape is there's been sort of a targeting of teachers who are sort of caught in the middle of the things that they know actually happened in U.S. history, or the things they know they need to teach, or the things that students need to confide in trusted adults like teachers and guidance counselors, and the politicians who are saying, well, no, you can't. And I'll give you examples. A New Hampshire parent group offered a bounty for anyone who caught a teacher talking about racism or sexism in schools, I think $500. A Pennsylvania elected official, a state representative, told right-wing parents to become substitute teachers just so they can spy on other teachers. This is a pretty intense anti-teacher sentiment that not only makes this one of the most difficult times to be a teacher, but also is part of this large national movement attacking public schools.
Yeah, Christina on our Facebook page wrote a challenge they see teachers facing is censorship by the political right. But it's being the way it's we read about it is a parents' bill of rights. Their parents have a set of rights when it comes to their child's education. How do you balance those in the classroom?
Well, you know, I think parents have the right. I'll give you an example. Let's talk about the books. Yeah. Parents have the right to monitor what their own child reads if that's how they want to parent. But they do not have the right to control what all children read. So parents, instead of just saying to their child, you know what, I don't want you to read a book about XYZ, they're saying ban the book entirely, take them out of the library. And worse, now they're talking about pressing charges against school librarians or teachers who have those books in their classrooms and make them accessible to students.
I'm glad you mentioned school librarians, because this is a part of your new book, The Teachers. Alexandra, talking about the role that school librarians play and specialist teachers play as well, and how those often seem to be the first things to be cut when it comes time for budgeting for education.
Librarians are extremely underestimated. Students are actually more likely to graduate, master academic standards, and score higher on tests if their school has a full-time qualified librarian. However, 40% of K-12 schools don't have a full-time librarian, and nearly a third of school districts in our country don't have any librarians at all. We need them. They're central to student success.
Alexandra Robbins, our guest, the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. You're welcome to join the conversation. Tell us what you see from where you are today at 1-800-642-1234. And the book details the lives, 1 year in the life of three teachers. And one of those teachers is Miguel, who you mentioned before, a middle school special education teacher. But I also become invested in some of these students that these teachers have in their classroom every way. And one of those that stuck out to me was the relationship Miguel had with Eli in his classroom through the school year. Can you share a little of that with us, Alexandra?
Yeah, Eli had a bad reputation in school. Prior educators had said, well, he comes to school late or he doesn't come at all. And then every year, regularly, he would bolt from the classroom for no reason. And so Miguel started the year saying, he told me, he said, I'm going to treat Eli like the student I want him to be rather than the student that I heard that he was. And he did. He just exuded such a warmth when Eli came to the classroom. When Eli came in, 2 hours late, Miguel wouldn't say anything about being late. He'd say, hey, Eli, I'm so glad you're here. It turned out Eli was homeless. So Eli was dealing with so many more challenges than meets the eye. And Miguel's hard work with him was a really inspiring story to follow.
Yeah, these classrooms don't happen in a vacuum. And you detail this in no uncertain terms in your book, the teachers, that it's part of the context that are part of the lives of the teachers and the students. But that classroom is so, indelible. I can still remember all the names of my grade school teachers, and they've all become a part of who I am today. So they don't happen in a vacuum. But do we recognize that as the role that these schools play in the lives that these kids have?
People aren't thinking about that. They're not thinking about the teachers. And there are so many teachers who told me they do this. When their kids are at recess, the teachers buy food. And when the kids are at recess, they stuff backpacks of food insecure children with the food so that they know that at least their family will have something to eat. Teachers are doing this, paying out of their own pocket. 94% of teachers pay for their own classroom supplies out of pocket, an average of $500 a year. Penny once spent $2,000 in a year. And part of that is looking out for kids who can't afford things.
Penny is one of the three teachers you detail in your new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I have to ask you, out of curiosity, after reading the book, did you find the three best teachers in America? Or are these just indicative of what you find in any classroom, in any school, everywhere?
Any classroom, any school, anywhere. There are so many teachers I could have followed. I interviewed hundreds. So many would have had great stories. I chose Rebecca, Penny, and Miguel because I knew that readers would both relate to their stories and find them captivating.
Let's go to your questions and comments now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Alexandra Robbins. Camille in New Berlin, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yes, putting more money into the schools. First of all, I was a teacher for over 30 years. I served 5 years on our local school board. If putting more money into the school means that superintendents can create new positions like assistant superintendents, more directors of curriculum, these are two-year contracts. That people earn 2 to 3 times what a teacher does, the average teacher does. And then you can't even get rid of them because if there's budget crunches, because they're on 2-year contracts. So unless we get a grasp on where the money is being spent and put it back into people who directly impact the lives of kids, we're not going to see much of a change.
Camille, thank you for your call and your observation. Alexandra, what do you see there?
Oh, I agree with that 100%. It's called central office bloat. People say, oh, well, we don't have any more money for the schools. Yes, we do. It's just that superintendents and district officials are putting the money into more district official positions, extra chiefs of staff, extra, assistant director of something or other. And Camille's exactly right. And they don't have anything to do with the students. They don't have anything to do directly in schools. And they make 6-figure salaries. It's ridiculous. Yeah, we have the money. It just shouldn't be going to the central office. It should be going to the teachers.
And as you detail in the teachers, it's when Miguel gets an aide in his classroom that seems to turn the entire school year around, even the students.
Yeah, Miguel was getting assaulted in his classroom on a daily basis. He was bitten, he was punched, he was hit. This was the year before I followed him that happened. And he kept complaining to the district saying, you keep sending me these moderately to severely disabled students, but you're not sending me any assistance. And I can't do this all by myself. And they kept saying, no, you're fine, no, you're fine. Then the district official in charge of assistance came to the school and he showed her the bite marks up and down his arm. And she shrugged and she said, well, that's just part of the job. Well, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It should not be part of the job.
Where else would that be part of the job except for maybe
exactly.
Mixed martial arts? I don't know outside of that, but there's no biting in mixed martial arts.
I hope not.
So one of the things you challenge in your book, Alexandra, is teacher burnout, and you provide a bigger perspective and say in some context, teacher burnout's a myth. Explain that.
Teacher burnout is a myth because, okay, so the phrase teacher burnout is a way of talking about exhaustion from overwork. It's misleading because experts say that the burnout for teachers is caused by inadequate workplace support and resources, high stakes testing, stuff like that. But instead of fixing these issues like any normal workplace would do, districts often say, well, the teacher should just do a better job of, and I'm air quoting here, self-care, as if it's on them to relieve the stress caused by a job that's impossible to do. So I say teacher burnout is a myth. The feelings that teachers have are extremely valid and they're going through this. However, it's not their fault. Instead of saying things like, oh, well, teachers have the highest burnout levels, we should be saying, no, school systems are the employer's worst at providing employees with necessary supports and resources.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for your new book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Alexandra Robbins, author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. I talked with her earlier this year about her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Coming up Monday on Central Time, Rob Ferret returns to talk with State Senator LaTanya Johnson about what building a budget looks like from inside the powerful Joint Finance Committee and what those decisions can mean for her hometown of Milwaukee. Plus, former Senator Russ Feingold joins Rob to discuss ethics in our judicial branch of government, from the lower court judges to the Supreme Court justices, and how they weigh on our scales of our system of justice. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from the author of a book about mothers who are online influencers and what they say about contemporary American motherhood. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, this week's edition of Food Friday is all about cooking on a tight budget. We'll talk to a mother of four who wrote a cookbook about making your money stretch in the kitchen. First, we're talking about momfluencers. You know, the beautiful blonde women who wear linen dresses and feed their adorable children perfectly homemade meals in their newly renovated beige homes. The ones who make motherhood spotless houses and getting toddlers to behave look not just fun, but easy. Our next guest describes herself as obsessed with momfluencers, even though she often comes away from scrolling through their Instagram feeds with mixed feelings. We're talking about what mothering looks like on social media and how it compares to the real deal. We want to hear what you think, moms. 1-800-642-1234. Do you follow any momfluencers online? And how do Instamoms make you feel about motherhood? And why do you follow them? Love to know. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Peterson is a writer and author of the new book Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did your obsession with momfluencers begin?
Yeah, it really started when I was a mother of a newborn and a toddler. I was a stay-at-home mom, and I found a blog. It was Love Taza was the name of the blog, and the momfluencer's name is Naomi Davis. And she lived in the Upper West Side of New York City. She had three kids. Her photos were beautiful. They were well lit. They were well composed. And her performance of motherhood was just really joyful. She made motherhood look like an adventure, sort of like she was starring in her own movie. And as a mother, you know, myself at the time, really struggling to find that sense of joy and ease in my own experience, I found this, you know, very performative aspect of motherhood online really interesting and sometimes maddening. But I wanted to sort of understand my own feelings about it better.
Yeah, they make it look so good and they make it look so easy. But then you start digging into what a day in the life of a momfluencer looks like. And what did you find, Sarah?
Yeah, it's a ton of work. I mean, you know, many of these women are photographers, they are editors, they're writers, they're businesswomen, they are, you know, dealing with brands and sponsorship deals. It's not an easy job, and only the top percentage of monetized momfluencers make enough to live on. Brooke Erin Duffy wrote a book about style influencers and female influencers in general and found that only about 9% make enough to support their families doing this. So yeah, it's a ton of work and it's skilled work for sure.
Yeah. And when many of us think of momfluencers or mommy bloggers, we tend to think of conventionally attractive married white ladies with beautiful homes selling expensive strollers. And that is a big part of it. But you write about how momfluencer culture is actually a lot more diverse than that. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. I mean, the momfluencer you were sort of speaking to, I think, is the predominant stereotype we think of when we think of momfluencer culture. But there are so many moms from all walks of life that you can find on Instagram and elsewhere, other social media platforms. Many of them are speaking about social justice issues. Many of them are providing really important representation. And this representation can be really powerful. I spoke to one disabled momfluencer who said that she only became a mother once she saw another mother in a wheelchair on Instagram and sort of, you know, felt like, oh, this is actually possible for me, because she just hadn't seen her identity represented in, you know, mainstream mom media.
Reading from your book here. And yes, Instagram sucks, of course, but it's but it's also an invaluable resource for advocacy and activism. One of the moms that sticks out in my mind from your book, Sarah, is Erica Nolan.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. She's a trans mom I spoke to for the book. And she has really used her platform to create more visibility about her experience coming out as trans. And again, she told me she doesn't know if she would have transitioned if she had not followed other trans women online first. So this is like a really, you know, meaningful way that representation goes beyond just, you know, I feel good because I see my identity represented online. It's making people, it's impacting people's real life choices.
And yet the veneer is obvious, I think, to anybody who looks at it. That can't be real. And to a degree, it's not. But what kind of effect does that sort of unreal and yet somehow empowering social media feed have on other mothers?
Yeah, I think it really depends. In the book, I talk a little bit about upward comparison theory and downward comparison theory. And so upward comparison theory is when we are maybe, you know, cringe following or quote unquote hate following someone whose values we don't agree with in order to sort of feel better about our own values and our own life choices. And downward comparison theory is when we are consuming content, you know, these people might be succeeding, or, you know, we might perceive these people to be succeeding in ways that we are failing. And this does have the effect of making us, you know, feel less good about our lives and less good about our choices. So I do think it's the type of thing where folks need to be really honest with themselves and sort of assess, like, how is this impacting my behavior? How is this impacting my well-being? Because once we consume these images, they really live inside us in ways that I don't think are necessarily easy to quantify.
Mm. Sarah Peterson, our guest. She is the author of the new book, Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 about your relationships that you see on social media, the performance of motherhood that you find, and the reality that is our lives. Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. And of course, a huge part of Momfluencer culture, Sarah, is consumerism. And I'd be curious from you, and it's parts in the book, some of the things you've bought as a result of the Momfluencers you follow.
I think maybe, I don't know, the quirkiest thing I've purchased is a wooden marble run. I don't know if you're familiar with marble.
I think I had one as a kid.
Yeah. So yeah, one of, you know, my pet Momfluencers, her kid was playing with this beautiful, you know, probably Swedish made wooden marble run. And I saw the image, I saw the kid playing, and I, you know, it translated in my mind as like, I can get free time, I can get quiet, you know, my kid will be as absorbed as her kid is with this marble run. And I think I spent like $73 on the marble run. And
shush.
Yeah. It wasn't a magical experience, I'll tell you that.
But we talked earlier this week with a researcher who talked about how when we scroll through social media, our defenses for impulse buying are lower just because our senses are overwhelmed with, you know, we're taking it all in, all these many things all at once. And all of a sudden something comes by that trips us up and stops us in our tracks. And we think, yeah, that might actually make a difference until mm-hmm. it arrives at your doorstep and you realize it probably won't.
Yeah, it's so true. And the, you know, the quick little dopamine hits you can also access so easily from clicking purchase now.
Yes.
And I think especially moms, you know, we're so unsupported in this country, and it makes sense that we want to feel hope that our lives can be easier. And it's silly, of course, to think that something like a marble run will meaningfully impact my experience as a mother. But in those moments, you're scrolling. The link is right there. Your credit card is saved in your phone or your computer. And it feels like one tiny step that you can make towards having a better experience of motherhood.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. Lisa in Madison joins us. Lisa, you're on the air with Sarah Peterson, the author of Momfluenced.
Hi, as a 53-year-old mother of now adult children, I don't pay attention to the mom influencers, but I think part of that is because of the awareness I had as I was growing up and looking through fashion magazines and the pressure to look a certain, you know, a certain height and a certain weight, and the reality behind how those women looked, it was just as unglamorous as some of the lies of these mom influencers, eating disorders and a lot of mental health problems and the pressure. So it's just kind of, this is a continuation of what women have seen as, you know, teenagers and now adults and mothers, the pressure.
Oh, you cut out, but your point was very well taken, Lisa, and thank you so much for the call. And I guess as I'm listening to Lisa here, I'm thinking there is a limited number of pages in these fashion magazines to present a limited view of what a woman is. But when you get online, you get to a certain degree, you get to call your own feed. You get to figure out where your follows will be. And there is, as you write in Momfluence, there is a large diversity of women to follow on social media.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the caller's right to point out that we've always been marketed and sold a certain way to be as women and as mothers. Just the medium has changed. And I guess what I find, compelling, troubling, interesting about this medium is, you know, how we can form parasocial relationships with these women. You know, if we're thinking about the fashion magazines from 20 years ago, sure, we could consume the narrative, you know, that we should all be a certain weight and we should all, you know, have a certain skin color and conform to certain beauty ideals. But we didn't know what their kid ate for breakfast. We didn't know where that model lived. We didn't know her husband's name. And I think knowing so much personal information about these people can make them that much more effective as consumer sites.
Fascinating. We're talking with Sarah Peterson about her new book, Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Moms, we want to hear from you. What do you think of the way motherhood's represented on social media? What do you want to see more of on your social media feed? And what do you want to see less of, for that matter? Do you follow any Insta-moms? And have the moms of Instagram affected the way you feel about yourself and your family? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our conversation with writer Sarah Peterson about her new book, Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. And your thoughts of momfluencers and the Insta-moms you find online, the veneer they present and the reality that we're living. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Sarah, you talk to a lot of women who make money from posting about motherhood, either full-time or part-time. How did they feel about their jobs?
Almost all of the people I spoke to for the book had complicated feelings about this. You know, I spoke to one woman who had been talking to a social media manager, and the manager was like, listen, if something bad happens in your day, if you cry, you need to film yourself, because that will get engagement, that will bring viewers in, that will create a compelling narrative. And just the idea of having to mine your personal, you know, trauma for clicks is so fraught to me, especially when it comes to motherhood, which is such a vulnerable experience for many of us. And you know, many of them talked about having tough experiences, revealing too much, or allowing themselves to be too open to their followers' feedback. I think it's a really tricky line to walk, because they're also expected to be, quote unquote, authentic. And that's a word that has ceased to mean much of anything at all, as far as I'm concerned. It's really just like what the consumer wants to see from you, to feel like, you know, if you're selling them something, an affiliate link or a sponsored content, you're doing it for good reasons. And I don't know, there's a lot of criticism lobbied towards momfluencers for making money from this, which I think is pretty ridiculous, because it is marketing, it is advertising, and they should be paid for their labor just the same way that marketers and advertising in traditional formats are paid for their labor.
Yeah, as you write about in the book, these moms of Instagram are expected to stay within particular economic configurations, and if they don't, all of a sudden they become inauthentic online. But you do raise a good question of what authenticity means when we're all willing to accept to some degree that what we're seeing is a presentation and far from the reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing about the momfluencers as a job is it eradicates the modern need to balance work and maternity, and it collapses the two. And considering, and you talk a lot about this in your book, what moms went through during COVID and how they are still recovering today, that was pretty important for a lot of mothers.
Yeah, I mean, most workplaces do not make room for a mother as a full person. She's expected to leave her mothering identity at the door. Otherwise, it's deemed, you know, unprofessional. And this is also why I think MLMs continue to thrive, because moms are not given ample resources to thrive in both professional settings and at home. Childcare is, you know, either exorbitantly expensive or impossible to find. And it makes sense to me that people are looking for, you know, loopholes, whether that's working for an MLM or whether that's momfluencing and trying to gain some sort of balance.
Sarah Peterson, our guest, the author of Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture, and we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And here's an email from Leah. Sarah, I'm curious to see what happens to these kids who have been online since birth. When they get old enough to know what their parents are posting and doing, they have rights to what their image is online, says Leah. And what emotional repercussions this may have for them?
That's, yeah, it's such an important question. I've been thinking a lot about child actors recently and, you know, really trying to suss out like how much knowledge and awareness do they have going into the industry. Certainly many of the moms I spoke to for the book are really open with their kids about like, you know, this is a business, I am earning money. Many of them put, you know, have trust funds for their kids and are putting aside a certain percentage of the money they make. But the issue of consent is really, really hard. And I think for many of these momfluencers who are millennials, and you know, they had their kids when Instagram was a new technology. And I don't think we were thinking necessarily about privacy and consent in the same way we are now. So I think it's a real concern. And other countries also have like legislation in place and policies in place to protect children and to make sure children are paid fairly. And I think that might be at least one way to safeguard children.
You end your book, Momfluence, Sarah, talking about the ideal of cruel optimism. Can you share a little bit about what that means and your thoughts on how it relates to motherhood?
Yeah, it's a theory by literary theorist Lauren Berlant, and it essentially posits this idea of longing for something, usually an ideal or an archetype, even when that thing that we're longing for prevents our flourishing or, you know, directly counteracts our ability to flourish. And I talk about my own story in the book, wanting to sort of inhabit this domestic ideal of motherhood, you know, be a goddess of the home. And in researching where that archetype stems from, you know, the 19th century cult of domesticity, where wealthy white women were upheld as the moral centers of the home, it's not coming from a great place. It's only certain moms could be quote unquote true women. And even those moms were oppressed. And any other type of mom that did not fit into that category of wealthy white womanhood was explicitly prevented from, you know, joining the club of quote unquote true women. And many of them were explicitly harmed because they could not adhere to that ideal. So, yeah, I think Momfluencer culture is a great example of cruel optimism. You know, it's normal and natural to want something better as mothers, but I think we have been continuously programmed to want an ideal that really is not good for us.
How did the momfluencers that you talked to for this book, Sarah, feel about the negative perception that many people have about their work?
Frustrated. I think namely because they are women and mothers, their work is denigrated as frivolous or as inconsequential. And the motherhood piece really shows up when people will say things like, oh, they should be spending time with their kids instead of looking at their phones, or oh, they just want me to buy something from them. They don't really care. And it's like, okay, so the mom who's working an office job 9 to 5 is also not spending time with her kid, but that's somehow different. There's this really misogynistic criticism of mothers having the audacity to make money, which I think is really wrapped up in this discussion.
Before the pandemic, we had for the very first time more women in the workforce than men. And during the pandemic, we dropped down to a level that had not been seen since the 1980s. And we had the job numbers out earlier today where those numbers are bouncing back again towards closer to pre-pandemic levels. But it goes back to the trying to have it all as a woman in America and how many forces are up against you and how for these momfluencers, in many ways, they're taking the opportunity in their own hands. I'm still curious a little bit more about the marginalized women in our society and where they find empowerment online and what you found about them, Sarah.
One important thing to remember about social media is that for all of its, you know, pitfalls and weaknesses, it is a democratic space. You know, anyone can create an Instagram account. And many marginalized moms have found real audiences and engagement online where they might not otherwise have. You know, if you think about writing and disseminating messages prior to social media, you had to jump through lots of gates. You had to have connections to academia or to the publishing industry or to TV and film. And without, you know, now with social media, many, many more people can create communities and can share their voices in meaningful ways. And certainly marginalized mothers have created vibrant, thriving, meaningful communities through social media. I think of Mia O'Malley. She's a fat momfluencer, and she crowdsourced a network of weight inclusive healthcare providers.
Sarah, I apologize. We're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there, but I really appreciate you joining me today. Sarah Peterson, she's the author of Momfluenced: Inside the Maddening Picture Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. We've got Food Friday coming up next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.